This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. Today, the value of an Australian carbon credit unit has jumped 20% since the election on Saturday. So what is driving that? You will find out a little later this hour on the Country Hour. And would you be prepared to pay an extra 20 cents for your next kilo of potatoes? Because that is what some growers say they need to survive. Shortly, you will hear from one Busselton grower who says if that doesn't happen, he's going to have to exit the spud industry.
If you really want to have local production of high-quality fruit and vegetables in Australia, we can't keep doing it for nothing. That is the message. We need help somehow, and the only way that we can make it sustainable is to get higher prices.
You'll learn more about that from the Busselton potato grower shortly here on the Country Hour before news headlines at 12:30. Transport Planning and Ports Minister Rita Saffiotti says the government is in the very early stages of looking at options to relocate livestock shipping from the Port of Fremantle. The state government has plans to revitalise and re-energise Fremantle's Victoria Quay as part of the Westport project, which will see a new outer harbour and container port built in Kwinana. Under the plan, $2 million will be spent investigating the feasibility of relocating livestock exports. The government says this relocation will create new options for Fremantle and a potential economic development opportunity for regional Western Australia. In Parliament yesterday, Nationals WA member for Roe, Peter Rundle, asked Rita Saffiotti for an update on the relocation plans.
I think it's very much a discussion with industry to see what would be of the most benefit, in particular of transport costs. You know, there's, I suppose, two differing views. One is that you head north, one is that you head south. So there's the two very divergent views of where it potentially the livestock could be traded from. But we're in very early assessment, and I'd rather have consultation with industry and before we make those decisions or create concern when there shouldn't, doesn't need to be.
So just further question, given the results of the weekend, it appears that yourself and the Premier are proactively supporting the industry with that budget allocation, etc., in comparison to your federal colleagues. So you're pretty confident of the ongoing future of the industry, the live export industry.
Yeah, I think the Premier's made the position pretty clear. So that's why we'll be continuing to work on an alternative port for livestock trade.
Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti, 12:08. Murray Frangs is the General Manager of RETWA, Rural Export and Trading WA, which is the country's biggest sheep exporter. Murray, how does your business feel about moving livestock exports out of Fremantle?
The industry is hugely supportive of this idea. We've been talking with government for 25 years about this. And I know that sounds like a long time, and it has not been an idle conversation. You know, we've had a lot of action promised by multiple politicians over the years. And while some of it's been wrapped up in the broader outer harbour development issues, the capacity for live exports to move has always been a possibility within existing facilities available in Kwinana. You know, even way back when Alana McTiernan was Transport Minister, this was a hot topic. Back when Troy Buswell was Transport Minister, this was a hot topic. You know, and in fact, I think it would have been in about 2011, Troy Buswell told transport operators that live exports would be relocated from Fremantle to another government-owned facility. They were keen to see live exports moved away from Fremantle to Kwinana, with space becoming an issue due to the developing of exports out of the inner harbour forecast to double.
So why hasn't it happened, do you think?
Look, as I say, a part of it is being brought up, tied up with the broader outer harbour development. I mean, that's a much bigger project. From a live export perspective, though, it's an easy soundbite maybe at the time when it gets brought up to move it out of the inner harbour. But when the rubber hits the road, which is part of it as well, nothing really comes about it. It's been quite disappointing. I mean, this initiative that Ms. Saviotti sort of raised here, you know, this initiative should have been done years ago, and it would have alleviated a number of issues the industry's up against. You know, live exports is obviously in conflict with other port users, and carting of livestock stock through built-up suburban areas, you know, it's causing a number of issues.
So can you give us a sense of those sort of day-to-day challenges that your company experiences exporting live animals out of Fremantle?
From a business sense, the situation at using, you know, Fremantle in the harbour, you know, there's a lot of efficiencies in loading ships with fodder and water, and that, you know, that are compromised because of conflicts with steel cargo and other users of the bulk loadout facility. From a social licence perspective, keeping this livestock trade in front of a population of people who really don't understand the industry continues to cause problems.
In what way?
Well, it's very visible, and you're trying to drive straight through downtown Fremantle through that. I mean, the broader getting trucks off out of the suburbs is always an underlying push for any of these movements, whether it's live exports or steel or containers. So from our industry's perspective, we could take all these additional truck movements out of the suburban areas.
How can a conversation around the relocation of livestock exports be justified, you know, at this moment under the current circumstances with a new federal government and a policy to phase out the sheep trade?
The industry really is hoping that the government will be looking at this industry with all the known information, data and facts that has been put to the governments over the years. The viability of the industry is strong. The record of the industry is strong. And, you know, we're just hoping that there can be an education process and happy to engage with all levels of government on this matter, just to show and prove that the industry is viable, strong, and does not compromise the welfare.
But at this time, would a state government spend millions of dollars relocating, setting up shop at a different location for the live ex trade, with the federal government saying it wants it to end sometime soon?
Yeah, those are definitely some interesting topics and discussions that are going to have to be held over time in understanding what the money that's being discussed here from the early assessment that was mentioned by Rita Saviotti. That's still for a planning money. It's not money that's applied to actually developing that. Some of the options down at Kwinana, require very little infrastructure to be able to manage this. We're largely, you know, largely mobile with all the equipment that's used. So it's not as if we need large infrastructure built. It's just using the existing berths that are there.
Minister Saviotti says that there are arguments to relocate south or north of Fremantle. What's your preferred option?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. That I definitely have to have a think about or try and understand what options that would entail. But for ourselves within the region, I think is quite important, because it does put us in the middle of the producing region, because we do bring in livestock from Geraldton through to sort of Albany. So if we would tend to be one end or the other of that supply chain, it would create quite a number of transport issues. So within the Fremantle, that's why it's there. That's why all the facilities that support that and the quarantine facilities are in due proximity of that. And so within Kwinana, it would just mean that we can keep operating with the infrastructure that's available.
But the government's saying that this relocation will create new options for Fremantle, obviously, and a potential economic development opportunity for regional Western Australia. So could that mean that Live X goes to, I don't know, Esperance, Albany, Broome?
Yeah, look, from either whether it's sheep or cattle, I'd be surprised if there's been too much in industry which would want to sort of centralise in those areas. Broome, certainly. Sorry, for relocating the industry that's using Fremantle, Broome certainly would not be an option. It would certainly assist the Kimberley and the operations and out of there, and, you know, to have an increased capacity for sure. But in terms of what it would be moving from Fremantle, that wouldn't really be an option.
Murray, always good to talk. Thank you so much.
Not a problem, Linda. Thanks for that.
Murray Frangs, he's the general manager of Retwa, the Rural Export and Trading WA, which is the country's biggest sheep exporter. This on the text from Peter. Rita Saffiotti can consult with the industry and should, but not like Minister Kelly did with the WA rock lobster industry or forestry, where decisions are made and then consultations begin. WA Labor has to drop banning live export from their party platform. Support the world best standard trade, or you destroy all the Australian pastoral lands and ruin our red meat prices, says Peter. As you heard from Minister Saffiotti earlier, she did reiterate that point, though, that the Labor Party is supporting the sheep trade out of Western Australia. You can have your say too on the text 0448 922 604, 12:15.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on The Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Great to have you along this afternoon. News headlines and then a look at the weather right around the state around about 12:30 today. First, though, the Yidjibandi traditional owners in the Pilbara are gearing up for another fight with mining giant Fortescue Metals. Their traditional country is on land where FMG mines iron ore at its Solomon Hub operations in the Hamsley Range. The Yidjibandi won native title in 2017, and the High Court refused to hear an appeal in 2020 by Fortescue founder and chairman Andrew Forrest. Negotiations over royalty payments fell through last year between the traditional owners and the miner, so now the Yidjibandi have returned to court to get a ruling on compensation. Yidjibandi Aboriginal Corporation Chief Executive Michael Woodley says it's a significant move.
I think it's going to be the first that I know of that a native title group is going to be taking a mining company to court for compensation for the reason that they don't have an Indigenous land use agreement for mining on our country.
Would it be fair to describe this as a landmark case, the first major native title compensation case?
Oh, for sure. I'm pretty sure that, you know, and quite confidently we can label it as that.
What is the significance of the case for the Yidjibandi?
Well, free, prior, informed consent, right? A mining company coming into our country, not doing the right thing, not being respectful, refuse to acknowledge native title rights and laws, and don't want to do an ILUA based on what we consider to be industry standards that mining companies and mining operations that operate within our area, which is the Pilbara.
So you were trying to negotiate an Indigenous land use agreement with Fortescue. So can you explain what that is?
Well, an Indigenous land use agreement is an agreement that is binding between the mining company and the First Nation, native title holders of that country. And it foregoes things like, liabilities or future liabilities as well, which ties in both parties to operate in a respectful, cohesive manner where, there's opportunities flowing, that would benefit both parties. And ILUA also, gives an opportunity for mining companies to work in a collaborative manner with the First Nations people as well, in particular to heritage matters, environment, the water, and to also, look at doing something positive, that we can build a structure of legacy that sees the people benefits and the community that situates near these operations are well off, after these mining operations are done and dusted.
Now, what sort of compensation are you predicting? You have said tens of billions of dollars.
Look, we're not willing to, make any type of prediction or statement on that particular issue at the moment.
You have said that in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, what I said in the past is that I think what Yidjibandi should be doing is something quite substantial, right? But until we sort of go through the process internally and look at what this conversation looked like from a economic point of view, right? And then there's obviously factors in there that we need to consider as well. One of the things that we kind of relying on as running this particular conversation case is looking at the Timber Creek case that made compensation on three areas: an economic loss, pre-loss, then there's the spiritual and religious loss, which is the pain and suffering what companies have intentionally done to the people while mining our country.
Why is it that there hasn't been an agreement between the Yidjibandi and Fortescue on compensation for mining on your land?
Look, that's been the question that's always been lingering for the past 12, 13 years, since we've actually got into this in dispute with FMG. At the end of the day, we can only assume from where we sit in terms of why FMG are not willing to do an agreement that is industry standard. But there's a question, I suppose, that FMG can only really answer. I mean, we've always been willing and open to reach an agreement and work together with this particular mining company. But that's a question that only FMG can answer.
What impact has this dispute with Fortescue had on your community?
Well, major dispute, right? There's a good book going around called Title Fight that kind of gives a inside, in-depth look at what's been happening in the last 10 years between, Ijebundi people with the Ijebundi people. I mean, obviously caused and started by FMG coming into our community and, not getting an ILUA based on their ideology of what an Indigenous Land Use Agreement is or should be. It's just been a very, sad part of history for the Ijebundi people. I never thought in a million years that we would be doing the kind of things that we were doing to each other, and caused by a stranger that comes into our community that no one knows to, have a group of Ijebundi people that's been together for a long, long time, and this is family as well, right? People who speak the same language, practice the same law and culture, come from the same area, and we, blood at the end of the day, right?
This dispute's really split the community, fueled by Fortescue.
Yeah, exactly, and quite destructively as well. I mean, some of the people in the community still don't even talk to each other.
Michael Woodley, he's the chief executive of the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation, and he was speaking to Sue Lannan in Sydney. A request was made to speak to FMG, and Sue says she got an email back just saying that the leadership team was at Davos and they were too busy to do an interview. FMG said the case will have no impact on mining operations at the Solomon Hub, and they did not expect it to have any material financial impact, whatever the determination of the case. 21 past 12 here on the Country Hour on the ABC, right across Western Australia. Many of Australia's potato growers are now wondering if they can keep farming spuds because import costs are so high and profits are so low. Tasmania's potato farmers met recently, just ahead of the next season, to discuss the challenges and brainstorm a few solutions. Michael Hayes and John Williams were both at that meeting.
Potatoes are a high input crop, and to get our margins we need higher yields, and higher yields mean higher input costs, like more volumes of inputs to get those higher yields. And because fertiliser's rising, diesel's rising, as we all know.
Just input costs either. It's costs because land prices have jumped by a third. Insurance, it's labour, they're all up, and they're all contributing to the bottom line. Another one that just came to me is labour shortage for harvesting. That's another issue. Labour shortage for farmers generally.
Well, a genuine question for both of you. You've fairly heavily indexed on the potatoes, as you mentioned, not just with growing them, but also with involvement in harvesting contract and the like. Looking at the state of the industry right now, how do you feel?
Oh, no, I think it's... potatoes were once an attractive option, but now there's a lot of other attractive options, and I don't think potatoes are up there. They're just not competitive.
Yeah, look, you never change for the sake of change or to chase the dollar, but unfortunately the margins on a per hectare basis with the risk factor of the high input costs, potatoes are a bit on the nose. I think the risk factor is nearly doubling in the costs of input costs on the last season. So you've sort of got to really look at what you want to do. You can grow a paddock of wheat and you've got a lot less risks without that sort of outlay. And we've had a couple of years of what we'd say we've had a couple of years where we've had an easterly rain that's dumped a large amount of rain, and that is what causes a lot of rot in potatoes and causes a lot of issues with quality.
So you mentioned wheat there. I've got to ask, would you look at doing wheat or adding more to... You mentioned you had a dairy enterprise as well. Is there a way you can index heavier on that and get away from potatoes? Is this the season that's going to make you ask those questions?
Family operation. We've had a discussion. We will cut our potatoes this year by, we're not 100% sure, but at least 10 hectares.
Yeah, we do grow wheat, but wheat is becoming an attractive option simply because of the projected world prices meant to be up considerably. So it's going to be a lot less risk, a lot less cost to grow, and good for your soil. So good, there's the straw as well. So I think there'll be guys looking to go that way.
Are there other alternatives?
Well, poppies is probably not doing so well, but the beef and the dairy going great, and a lot less risk.
Potato growers John Williams and Michael Hayes speaking to Luke Radford about some of the challenges facing potato growers in northeast Tasmania. 25 past 12. Well, some Western Australian potato growers are in exactly the same situation. Keith Taylor farms near Busselton in WA's southwest, and growers in his area attended a crisis meeting this week. And at the end of that, there was one clear message. If potato growers and wash packers aren't paid more by the major supermarkets, they'll just have to exit the industry.
We are getting desperate because cost of production has gone through the roof and prices have actually been static or going down for the last few years. So we're getting desperate. That's the reason for the meeting.
Can you paint a bit of a picture of how many growers are there and what was the general mood?
The general mood was not upbeat, definitely not. We've got 8 growers left in this area. A few years ago, there was around about 20 or 30 in the area, and it's gone downhill. The numbers have gone downhill, as in other agricultural areas, and there's only 8 of us left now.
So was talk of what can be done to fix the problem, or was talk much more sort of negative, I guess?
There's, of course, negative talk, but people are focused on getting a price rise somehow, and we'd rather do it through cooperation through the supply chain rather than confrontation. We realise fully that now that the industry's deregulated, we are exposed entirely to the large supermarket chains, and we would like to get some cooperation from them. And we're not the only ones. It's happening right around Australia at the moment. If we can get a bit of a help from them, and they only need to give us a little bit, we'll all stay viable. But we're not viable at the moment.
What are the lines of communication like between the growers, the wash packers and supermarkets?
We don't have any direct involvement with the supermarkets. We do have great relationship with our wash packers, and most growers now do. There's only 4 wash packers left in Western Australia, and most of the smallish or medium-sized growers like us are aligned to one of those wash packers. So we're talking with them regularly, but we realise that they're very much the meat in the sandwich, and without them getting a price rise, we can't get a price rise.
Well, we'll get to what I guess the magic number would be in a minute, but I guess generally the cost of production's increased about 17% since October, whereas the price you're getting for the potatoes has increased very, very slightly, so obviously not in line with that. How long is that sustainable for if it's not sustainable already?
It definitely hasn't been sustainable for quite a while now, and it's become even worse with the rapid increase of cost of production. And there's a number of people talking of exiting the industry or scaling back or whatever. I mean, that's up to individuals to decide. But at the moment, we are committed for the time being, but in the long run, when I say the long run, it might only be a year or so, we would have to look at exiting the industry if we don't get a price rise. Mm. It's as simple as that.
And that's 17% in the cost of production. Can you just briefly explain what's involved in that?
The big ones are fertiliser, fuel. There's been slight increases in chemicals. But over the years, we've had gradual increases in nearly all of our inputs. But the recent ones are just astronomical. And we're not the only ones that are faced with that. All farmers, and I mean, everybody's familiar with price rises in fuel. I mean, our fuel bill is going to double this year. That takes a lot of potatoes to make that up.
So the potato industry, I guess, if you look at it like a chain, it starts with the seed growers and moves on to you guys, then to the wash packers. Is this impacting all levels of the industry, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's impacting all levels of farming, all fruit and vegetable producers. We're all in the same boat. And if you really want to have local production of high-quality fruit and vegetables in Australia, we can't keep doing it for nothing. That is the message. We need help somehow, and the only way that we can make it sustainable is to get higher prices.
What is the figure you think that the industry is aiming for or hoping for?
At the retail level, you only need a few percent, and if that's passed back to us, we need something in the order of 20 cents a kilo, which is, I know that sounds a lot to some people, but you've got to realise that for a long time now, most of us in the industry have been treading water. We haven't been making much progress. So we're already coming off a low base. Therefore, we need quite a substantial increase in the price to even stay in the industry, let alone progress as we should.
And when you talk about skin in the game, I mean, a lot of growers in Busselton here would have just are in the process of harvesting now and planting for the next crop. It's a bit of a gamble, I guess, really.
Absolutely. We're having very serious discussions as a family, and I know other growers are in a similar position as to how much you commit to the future. Personally, we are only potato producers. We don't have any other enterprises, so we are committed for the short term, but we are definitely looking at other options. Other crops, maybe exiting the industry, doing all sorts of other things, because if we don't get some relief shortly, there's no point in getting up each morning knowing you're going to lose a lot of money.
Second generation potato farmer Busselton's Keith Taylor speaking to Anthony Pansier. 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Time for an update from the newsroom with Jonathan Hopper.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says Beijing views its security pact with Solomon Islands as the first of many within the region. Overnight, it was revealed China is seeking deals with 10 Pacific Island nations covering policing, security and communications cooperation. It comes as China's foreign minister embarks on a trip to 8 Pacific nations over the next 2 weeks. Two more people have died with COVID-19 in Western Australia. It comes as the state records 11,832 new cases, continuing an overall downward trend. Premier Mark McGowan says there are currently 312 people in hospital with the virus, including 6 in intensive care. And an epidemiologist says health authorities could change the advice for a fourth dose for healthy Australians under 65 if the vaccine's protection begins to wane. Otagi recently expanded the eligibility for a fourth dose to include anyone who has cancer or a complex health condition and Australians living with a disability. Thanks, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you so much for that update. 29-1.
This week on Landline, farming macadamias and carbon.
It's been a lot of work that we've put into different processes, and it's a goal that we weren't originally looking to kick.
And the abattoir choir. That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
28-1. Between now and the news at 1, off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market today. And with this cooler weather, you might have started to put on a few more stews. I know I did that over the weekend. It was this great beef, barley, vegetable stew. Put it on the slow cook for hours and it was amazing at the end of that. But have you noticed, if you've been doing things like that, you might have noticed the price of zucchinis, because in some cases, prices are up 500% in some stores. And that is because only a few WA farmers have put in an early zucchini crop this season. More about that shortly when you head to Carnarvon to catch up with one of the farmers in that patch. First, though, it is off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Angeline Prasad, how's it looking around the Southwest Land Division?
Good afternoon, Belinda. Yes, fairly benign conditions under the influence of a ridge of high pressure. There is a chance of showers and even the odd thunderstorms about the southwest coast. There's a little bit of instability through that part near the south coast. And over the next couple of days, we'll see a stronger cold front move through through the south coast. So that is likely to bring increased showers and the possibility of thunderstorms as well. It's a stronger cold front, and we see a deep low pressure system developing in the Bight. So the low pressure system won't affect WA, but with that deepening low pressure system, we are going to see gales in our coastal waters, and there's that risk of damaging surf with that deepening low pressure system that might be directed onto the coasts in the south, especially from Sunday onwards. And there's also a risk of damaging winds, especially near the coast of Eucla. Might extend a little bit further inland, especially east of Forrest on Sunday afternoon. So But until that happens, you know, fairly benign conditions across the southwest land division, we're not expecting much weather. However, across the northwest of WA, sort of through the Pilbara and the northern parts of the Gascoyne, we are seeing yet another cloud band develop. And this is, I think it's the fifth cloud band of the year, and it's to do with the ocean sea surface temperatures to the northwest of Australia. Basically, it's associated with a negative Indian Ocean dipole, which is a measure of temperature in the Indian Ocean. So when we see warmer temperatures, sea surface temperatures closer to Australia, northwest of Australia, we tend to see more frequent cloud bands. So that's likely to happen over the next couple of months. Now, this cloud band is likely to bring rainfall from tomorrow across parts of the Pilbara and initially the northern parts of the Gascoyne, and some of it may extend into the interior. So rainfall totals, it could get significant. There's still a fair amount of uncertainty in the gardens, but we could potentially be looking at over the next 4 to 5 days, generally 25 to 50 millimetres across parts of the Pilbara and the far northern parts of the Gascoyne, and potentially 50 to 100 millimetres sort of in the area between Karratha and Onslow all the way to Exmouth. This cloud band could extend into the Kimberley early next week. It has been rather dry across the Kimberley, so warm and dry. So there is that risk that the cloud band could also extend into the Kimberley, especially across the southern parts of the Kimberley. So we could see some rain there early next week as well.
So pretty unusual, would you say, Angeline, to see these sort of cloud bands coming across at this time of year?
Yes, it is very unusual, and it is associated with the sea surface, the warmer sea surface temperatures. Depending on what's happening in the Indian Ocean, you know, we can see cloud bands every week, which is what we have been seeing over the last month or so, a cloud band developing across the Pilbara. So the rainfall currently that we've seen in the last four to six weeks across the Pilbara is very unusual. So this is more like the rain that we normally see during the wet season and associated with a tropical cyclone. But this is really, you know, like a deepening cloud band is just it picking up so much moisture from the Indian Ocean and just dragging it across the northwestern parts of WA. So the cloud band is going to last into next week. So it's going to persist for a few days. There's already cloud thickening across the southern parts of the Pilbara and the northern parts of the Gascoyne today, but it'll sort of start to precipitate from tomorrow.
And then this afternoon, Angeline, any warnings?
So we don't have any warnings thanks to the benign weather conditions that we're currently experiencing. So no marine warnings or fire weather warning. However, this weekend we are looking at coastal wind warnings to return from Saturday onwards. So strong winds initially, but they will develop into gale warnings, especially Leeuwin coast and further east along the south coast. We will see gales developing through those areas. There's that risk of damaging winds and hazardous surf on the south coast. So we are potentially looking at issuing warnings there. Now, as that cloud bank develops across the northwest, especially from Saturday onwards, there's that risk of heavy fall. So we will be looking at issuing more warnings with that.
Thank you, Angeline. Appreciate it. 22 to 1. And in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, the only part of WA that got more than 3 millimetres of rain was the southern coastal region. And Esperance got 5. And Noongarup's GRDC had 13 in the gauge. And that's it. Nationally, the Bureau of Meteorology has just released its winter 2022 climate outlook, and it shows a slowly weakening La Niña will probably result in above average winter rainfall for most of central and eastern Australia in the next few months. It says parts of southwestern Australia and southwestern Tasmania are likely to have below average rainfall this winter. The long-term winter outlook from the BOM is based on a developing negative Indian Ocean dipole, a slowly declining La Niña in the Pacific Ocean, and warmer than average waters around northern Australia. If you'd like more detail on that outlook, it is on the BOM website. Just search BOM, B-O-M, Climate Ahead, and you should find the right page to have a read through. 21-1. Just before the news at 1, off to Matt Barker for the results of the cattle market. First, though, have you ever thought that some agricultural research is a bit removed from the real, you know, day-to-day on the farm? Well, in an effort to better connect research to farmers, the Deputy Director of Curtin University's Centre for Crop and Disease Management has just spent a few weeks helping to put in a crop in the ground in Western Australia's eastern wheat belt. Professor Josh Milne has spent most of his working life in laboratories, and he has a background in agrochemicals. But he says he would highly recommend more researchers get out and spend some time working on the farms.
I'm out on Clint Delabosca's farm. We're about half an hour south of Southern Cross in the Yilgarn, and then a little bit to the west of Marvel Lock. So it's right on the very edge of the eastern wheat belt in Western Australia.
And tell us what you're doing there.
I'm helping him seed. So I've come out here. This is actually my last day. I've been out here 12 straight days helping Clint and his dad, Wayne, with their seeding.
So how did you find yourself there, Josh? You didn't just stumble across Clint's place.
No. Well, I've got three sons, and the second one's in year 12. And at the end of the year, he was going to go harvesting with a bunch of his mates. And I said I'd come because I thought it'd be really interesting and I'd learn a heap and I'd get to hang out with my son. And I was telling my director of my centre that, and he said, oh, that's great. Because I was talking about what sort of leave to take, you know, how do I take 2 weeks to go and do something like that? And he said, oh, no, don't, just call it field work. And then he said, and do you want to go and do some seeding as well? And I went, oh, okay. So I just looked at the diary and I could do it. So I did. And yeah, that's that.
Now, we know that there's a worker shortage in regional Western Australia, partly due to COVID and border restrictions and that kind of thing. But as you say, this is really professional development for you as well. It's quite different to your day job.
Yeah, so I work in a lab most of the time or supervise a lab. I've got a group that research herbicides and fungicides. So the herbicide work, we try and find completely new modes of action for herbicides using mostly protein biochemistry and structural biology. And the fungicide work we're doing is about the longevity and the survival of fungicides inside the plant and what the plant does to it and how it changes it from the starting material to something else. Very different. I did actually grow up in country, Queensland. So I grew up in Pittsworth, but we were townies. And then I moved to Toowoomba for high school. And after that, it was the big smoke once I sort of did science and things. So it's kind of nice to be back.
So, I mean, what can you take from this? What are you learning? And will you be able to sort of make some practical applications to future research with it?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot. I'm not sure if it'll change exactly the day-to-day what we do in the lab. But, I mean, as for how much I've learnt, it's, you know, have you got half an hour? I mean, I've learned how air brakes work. I learned the difference between a coulter wheel and a press wheel. And, you know, I can drive a loader now. And but, I mean, more relevant to what I was doing, I suppose I've been seeing the agrochemicals being mixed up. I'm seeing how combinations are being used. I can see how it's used hand in hand with the seeding program and how you can essentially get rid of the volunteers and the weeds and favour your crop and the way those two things go hand in hand. So, yeah, just a bigger perspective on how agrochemicals get used. I mean, I've actually been the chemical water gopher for most of the time. So I've done a lot of different things, but one of the big roles has just been ferrying water back and forth to the sprayer and reloading the chemicals. So it's been a huge education.
So do you think that other researchers in the field should maybe go out and spend a little bit of time on a farm to, I suppose, have that more rounded understanding of how their research can be and will be applied on farm practically in the future?
Oh, look, it certainly can't hurt. I mean, there's a labour shortage. I think they're glad for any help they can get at the moment. But more the point, yeah, I mean, I've been working on plants ever since, I suppose, 1996. You know, and when you're ticking the box of what is my science relevant to, we always tick the agriculture. And so to keep on ticking that box and saying this is the area that I work in and yet not to have that hands-on experience. So I don't think it hurts, that's for sure.
Curtin University Professor Josh Milne, he is the Deputy Director of the Centre for Crop and Disease Management. He was speaking to Tara de Landgraaf about his 2 weeks seeding on Clint Delabosca's grain farm, which is about 370 kilometres east of Perth. Sounds like it was very worthwhile. 16-1. Australia's carbon farming industry has reacted quickly to a change of the federal government, with the value of an Australian carbon credit unit jumping 20% since the election on Saturday. Dr. Tim Moore is from RegenCo, and he says the price of a carbon credit has increased so quickly because the new government has a new policy setting for the sector.
The results of the election have had a, you know, obviously a material change on carbon price in the last couple of days, and that very much boils down to sentiment around about how the new Labor government is going to implement carbon policy and emissions reduction policy. So the previous government had a policy of -26% to -28% of emissions on 2005 levels by 2030. The Labor policy is 43% reduction on that same time frame out to 2030. And so as a consequence, there's an expectation that industry is either going to have to work harder at reducing their emissions or turn to Australian carbon credit units as another pathway to reduce their emissions.
It's a sudden boost to the demand.
Absolutely. So it effectively, we're anticipating an increased demand as a result of new government policy.
So right now, at roughly $36 per credit, where does Australia sit in terms of the global carbon credit market?
Australia would have to be seen as some of the cheapest carbon credits on regulated markets around the world, sort of oscillating around about $100 Australian for the EU market. New Zealand's around about $60 Australian. Last time I looked, South Korea is well advanced in pricing on Australia. And so for those benchmark credit types, Australia is very cheap in comparison to international prices.
Looking at the carbon credit graph for the last 12 months, it went from about $20 a credit to over $55, and then a huge crash after the former Energy Minister Angus Taylor. Can you remind us on what he did and the effect?
So under the previous government, the policy was for the taxpayer to be buying carbon credits from the market. And so the taxpayer was effectively, you know, had spent or allocated through the government around about $3.5 billion to buy carbon credits from the land sector in particular. So that was a huge spend by the Australian public to secure carbon credits, but they were fairly firm contracts. And so the government was firm on price and volume there, which meant there were very few carbon credits available in the open market for anyone else other than the Australian government who had a perception that they're going to need credits into the future. And so we saw a huge amount of pressure on price. So we sort of, as you noted, we sort of went from $15 to $20 at the start of last year. We got close to $60. And effectively, what the previous climate minister, Angus Taylor, did was reduce the pressure in the market by saying to all of those big contract holders that were committed to selling their credits to the Australian government, you can get out of those contracts and sell your credits into the free market, but that's going to come at a cost. And so what we see there is that suppression of price because of increased supply, in effect. It's a pretty raw dynamic there.
Mm. Like any industry, I'm sure those involved in carbon farming just want certainty. What would that look like for those in this industry?
In particular, from our perspective, for the landholders, what we'd really love to see is TLC from the government. So transparency, longevity and certainty. Having those aspects in carbon and climate policy is really going to make our investment decisions and long-term decisions by landholders in how they manage their land and assets with regards to carbon markets, right? So these are long-term decisions for landholders and carbon project developers such as ourselves. So that sort of long-term view of what policy is going to be, transparency about how government's going to make decisions, and that gives us certainty to then go and invest. So changing policy, as we've seen with, you know, Minister Taylor's intervention in the market, suppresses price or changes price, and that removes confidence in the market, which makes investment much more uncertain. So longevity in policy decisions and transparency around those processes is going to be critical.
Dr. Tim Moore, he is Head of Science for RegenCo, speaking to Matt Brann. 12 minutes to one. Have you noticed zucchini prices are higher than usual? Well, this year, only a handful of Western Australian farmers had an early zucchini crop in the ground, and that has pushed prices up 500%. 100% in some stores. Vegetables WA Chair and Carnarvon farmer Dan Kuzmicic says there are a number of factors having an impact on supply.
They're traditionally a very cheap product, cheap to grow and cheap to harvest and cheap to pack as well. And normally from the bottom end, 20 cents a piece. If you're lucky, 40 to 50 cents a piece. At the moment, I think they're above $1.50. The supply is really low. So it comes down to supply and demand. And if you've got nice premium fruit, you are going to get the top dollar, so which is great for the grower.
Farmers haven't been growing zucchinis this year. Is it only because of labour? Are there other factors to consider as well?
Growers haven't planted early season with zucchinis because they basically haven't got labour, and you can't, and they grow very quickly. So you could, in summertime, you can pick them twice a day. You can literally just watch them grow. So I think that's the issue while the supply is down. The growers just haven't put any in. We had a really bad rain earlier this year. That, I think, played a factor as well. Also, with all the rain that's fallen within the outskirts of town and within the growing regions, abundance of weed starts growing, which the aphids start hosting within that weed. And then you've got a hygiene problem on farm. Aphids come in, start spreading disease. Zucchinis are very susceptible to disease. So a few people probably had them in and got decimated by disease, which you have to just clean them out straight away. So there's a lot of factors in play.
And how do you mitigate the risk of that, or how do you deal with the situation when it does arise?
Well, once again, you need a labour force to help control the weeds, number one. And then in between, if you need to harvest, well, once again, you need a labour force to harvest your product. So the growers are experts in knowing what to do. But if you haven't got the labour force, you are pretty much stuck.
Have you experienced instances, or have you heard of others experiencing instances where there is just some crop that's just left in the ground too long?
Yes, I have a good friend of mine that's down south who grew tomatoes and lots of tomatoes. He sent me pictures of his tomatoes that went red ripe on the vine. He just didn't have the labour force to harvest them. So since that has happened, he's given up growing tomatoes.
Carnarvon farmer Dan Kuzmicic, who's also chair of Vegetables WA, he was speaking to Sophie Johnson about why you might be finding it hard to find some zucchinis at the shops right now. And this year is the first time in 20 years that Dan has grown zucchinis, so he couldn't have got that timing better, could he? 8 minutes to 1. It is only May, but already some green mangoes from the Northern Territory have found their way to the Sydney markets. Now, the green ones, the mangoes, are sour in taste, and they're often used in salads and chutneys. Vin Nguyen is a wholesaler at the Sydney markets and says it's an early start to the season.
We've been doing green mangoes, just a few boxes here and there, about 2 weeks ago. Only recently it's come in not full swing, but starting to get a bit more volume. Hopefully we'll see a bit more volume following week, and they're getting good returns now. So we are wholesaling currently at $15 a kilo. Yeah, $15 a kilo for green sweet and green sour. And we do have some second grades between 10 and 12, depending on their quality. We've also got some green Kensington Prides. Green Kensington Prides we got out at about $100. And then again, some seconds for about 60 to 50, depending on the size again.
Is it just me, Vin, or do these come in earlier and earlier every year?
Every year, everything's a little bit earlier, a little bit earlier. That said, we'll probably see the season finish early again. Just depends on how it is up there in Darwin.
I think I've seen the price higher, though.
About 140, 120 previously.
Yep.
And I think the quality was there as well, as better quality for that sort of money.
Vin Nguyen, a wholesaler at the Sydney markets, speaking to Matt Brann. Not far away from looking at the details of today's Mount Barker cattle market. Just before that, though, if you're a regular user of Meat and Livestock Australia's statistics database, you might have noticed the foreboding message that change is coming. Basically, the MLA is changing the way it gives access to its information. Angus Murray is a transformational analyst for Meat and Livestock Australia and says this will mean in the future more up-to-date information will be available to the public.
We're looking for a brighter future and in which way that we can present this data more timely and accurately. And in doing so, we'll be able to drive greater insights to producers, processors and industry members.
And when you talk about changes, what will people who use this database notice?
So the current reports that are generated out of the statistics database, we're modernising the way that the look and feel of that is, and also the data behind that is going to be attached to our live databases rather than currently it's sitting behind some old data systems that don't get updated quite as frequently. So they'll be able to get live data updates for their current markets, for their current statistics within the industry, as well as we're going to start producing some reports for overseas markets as well. And we're going to be able to get a greater look on the whole industry itself.
How many people use this database?
It's a very renowned platform. We have quite a few users. Unfortunately, with the current systems, we're not able to track entirely who uses the platform itself. But from what we've found, it's highly regarded in the industry and well used. So we're looking to maintain that and improve that as part of this and actually expand its potential in the industry. And that's the main driver of this change.
So when do these changes happen?
The changes are going to roll out across September to the external members, and we're going to slowly ease that across. We've already put a little link to a form that you can sign up to hear the updates, and we're going to provide those updates to the people who sign up as well as publicly on our mailing distribution. But you should see those changes start to roll out over September and basically end through to October.
Angus Murray, he was always destined to work at Meat and Livestock Australia. He was speaking to Peter Somerville. It is 4 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. The war in Ukraine and the rising price of coal pushing up electricity bills for millions of Australian households. Hopes the latest shooting tragedy will spur the US to do something about gun control laws. And it's 5 years since the Uluru Statement. Now, with a new government in Canberra, there are renewed hopes for Indigenous constitutional recognition. Those stories and more coming up this lunchtime on The World Today.
It is 3 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. To the markets now. And the total yarding at today's Mount Barker cattle sale was 671. So numbers up almost 100 on last week's figures. Tracy Kilner is at the Mount Barker sale yards. Tracy, how did it go today?
Hi, Belinda. It was a good sale. Numbers were up for a mainly good quality yarding. Weaner heifers dominated the numbers, with prices fluctuating on quality. The weaner steers topped at 682 cents and heifers at 590 cents a kilo. A small offering of cows and bulls seen a price increase this week. Heavyweight weaner steers over 330 kilos sold from 600 to 652 cents. Medium weight and lightweight steer calves returned from 570 to 682 cents. Heavy weaner heifers sold from 420 to 540 cents, depending on quality. Medium weights returned 460 to 590 cents, and lightweight heifers from 420 to 582 cents a kilo. Yearling steers sold for 470 to 648 cents, quality dependent, while the yearling heifers returned 420 to 482 cents a kilo. Grown steers made from 308 to 380 cents. Trade heifers sold for 344 to 358 cents, and the feeder restocker heifers returned 314 to 392 cents a kilo. Heavy prime cows made 290 to 330 cents. Medium weights returned 330 cents, while store cows sold from 260 to 292 cents to processors and from 250 to 268 cents to restocker buyers. Heavy bulls gained, selling for 290 to 300 cents, and lightweight bullies were in demand, returning 448 to 550 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for going through those details at Mount Barker today. Nearly time for the news, about a minute or so away. Earlier in the hour, you heard from Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti just saying that the government is now in the very early stages of looking at options to relocate livestock shipping from the port of Fremantle. And you also heard from Murray Frangs, who's the general manager at Retwa, so the country's biggest sheep exporter, just saying this conversation has been going on for a very long time. His business would love it to be moved out of Fremantle to Kwinana, for example. I think you said the conversation's been going for about 25 years or so. This on the text from Bert. Reshifting live exports out of Fremantle, the current Minister for Agriculture needs to be asked why, when she was planning infrastructure minister, did the government of the day continue to block the James Point Investor Group, who had proposed and invested in all planning and environmental approvals beginning in 1997 to build a multi-user berth for livestock steel, scrap steel, etc., free of taxpayer dollars. The group eventually was forced to give up due to never-ending red tape and costs. The facility would have provided immeasurable benefits to the community and the live export trade. Bert, thanks for that text. Time for the news. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.